The Winners Club is the weekly podcast that shares the highlights and insights from some of the most meaningful and impactful conversations from the number one community on Clubhouse, The Winners Club.
This is our very, very great pleasure this afternoon to have an interview with one of the leading founders of a footwear brand of all time. In fact, I've got to admit here, I'm having a fanboy moment. I was the world's biggest fan of the Reebok Classic. I absolutely love it. Me and my brother-in-law, we still get fresh Reebok Classics. So I'm super excited for this conversation. Joe Foster is joining us this afternoon to talk about his journey from the back streets of Bolton to building a billion-dollar brand with Reebok. The conversation will be curated by our good friend, John O'Brien, MBE, who's at the top right-hand of the screen right now. So, John, if I may, I'll hand it over to you, my friend.
Well, thank you, James, and it's great to be back in the Winners Club. Thank you, Paul, also for opening up this room, and I see a number of our good friends and fellow members of the club in the audience, which I know people will be coming up and joining us on stage shortly. I always consider the stage is really the front row, so those who got in here early and that we know, it's tremendous to have you up here. Joe, it's fantastic to have you as a guest here on the Winners Club, which really is a community that I came across a few months ago, set up by Ashley Shipman with James Burt and Paul Abercrombie, our host today, about building a community to share knowledge and share insights. And Joe, it's been a great pleasure for me also to be able to read through your book over the last couple of weeks away in a place, part of the world I know you're very fond of, the Lake District. So welcome to the stage, and it's great to have you here.
Hello, John. My mic was closed. It's open now. I think my technician was was working on it, so we're okay. John, thank you. Thank you for the invitation. I'm fine, and nice to hear you're in the Lake District. Where we are now in France is very similar to the Lake District. Beautiful roads, nice up and down valleys, and there's no traffic. So it's wonderful.
Well, that's great, Joe. And actually, I have to say, you can't say the same about no traffic in the Lake District. I mean, I actually came back from it the weekend, but it does get, particularly in these times where people are bursting out and no doubt putting their running shoes on, getting up the fells and things of that kind as well, which is good. But Joe, I have to say that, and this is no two ways about it, I went away and I went off grid. And the book that I took with me was Shoemaker, the book which you know, obviously, you've got out at the moment. And just by way of background, I want to sort of say to people, I mean, we all know about Reebok. We all think of Reebok as one of those great institutions, iconic brand that's sort of almost always been there in our consciousness. But Joe, I can absolutely recommend the book because you have an extraordinary story there of, frankly, building a business in a time, well, over a time period, which is, you know, quite staggering in terms of the changes in technology and the way businesses operate and all the rest of it. So can I just ask to take you back and to put into context, what I really enjoyed is actually you talk about your grandfather, and obviously there's a lot about your family, and I won't go into all that. What resonates to me was that you were coming from a family that had already been successful in being innovative in the footwear business. A little bit of insight into your grandfather's great fame and effort there.
Well, you know, it's surprising this, that as Jeff and I grew up, we knew very little about our grandfather. Grandfather died in 1933. I think Jeff was about 4 months old. I wasn't even born. And we didn't learn too much about him. And it's funny that it really was when we were doing quite nicely with Reebok that we decided to look back into the history. We know that he'd supplied, I think it was Dynamo, Moscow Dynamo with boots and one or two things. We knew the window at the shop had been blown in a couple of times during two world wars. But the funny thing is we said, you know, we had a bit of money and we had some people there. And so we got them to dig back. And we found out so much. In 1895, he made himself, well, he probably invented the running spike. If he didn't invent it, he certainly pioneered it, because he made for himself in 1895, when he was 15 years old, a pair of running spikes. He wasn't a good runner, but he was part of this Bolton Primrose Harriers club, and he was probably midway as far as running in the field, and he made himself the shoes, and he came second. Wow. Well, that was the start of a business, because everybody looked at him and said, oh, well, we need a pair of those shoes, Joe. And so that was the start of his business. And by 1904, he had 3 world records in one day in his shoes by Alf Schrubb. And from then on, gold medals, lots of gold medals. Unfortunately, of course, World War One came along and that stopped athletics. And there's still a bit of football, but they went into repairing army boots. And then it was the second decade of the 20th century, 1920s, when we have a letterhead. We actually discovered a letterhead when we were digging away there through the history. And on that letterhead, there's 96 teams, mostly football teams. A lot of them are rugby teams. Police supplied every football club that you can mention. I can mention one, well, I will mention one, that was Tottenham Hotspur. It's the only one not on that list. Chelsea, Arsenal, Man United, Man City, Liverpool, you name them. They were all there. Fantastic. And he supplied all the Olympic runners in the 1920 Antwerp Olympics. And I'm sure in 24 and 28 he also did that, because he supplied the 3 athletes in Chariots of Fire. I think a lot of people, certainly in the UK, know Chariots of Fire, and it was Eric Liddell, Harold Abrahams, and Lord Burley. And they were immortalised in that film, Chariots of Fire, and they all won their gold medals wearing Joe Foster's shoes.
Joe, I absolutely love this, and I should just explain to everybody, just for ease, Joe is named after his grandfather, and Jeff was his slightly older brother. And I think, you know, what we might come on to when we get on to questions, etc., is whether or not, you know, being an entrepreneur, being an innovator is actually in the blood, you know, because your grandfather certainly did that, and I was fascinated. I used to wear running spikes when I was a runner in the army. And, you know, I never really thought that somebody had to invent them. So actually hearing that story, and as you say, Chariots of Fire is a tremendous film that is internationally renowned and known. But the fact that your grandfather secured the ability to provide the Olympic team that won those golds is just fantastic in the rich heritage that you started with. But of course, people need to buy the book and people need to read the rest of the story and let's say the relationship with your father, etc. Because what happened, you know, particularly was that you and your brother decided actually to break from that business. And this is where I think, you know, the start of Reebok and the start of the challenges, because the observation I would make, Joe, if you don't mind, is that, of course, you're quite active on Clubhouse, and you'll know that the average age of people on Clubhouse is certainly younger than me, let alone younger than yourself. I mean, you know, it's in the public domain. You're in your 9th decade. So, you know, this is tremendous to have you here. But the world of business that you were starting out with is so entirely different in many ways, but there will be similarities, which I'm sure will come out through the conversation. But, you know, the spark of deciding that you were going to not persevere with the family business, but with your brother strike out in your own, was driven by you seeing an opportunity, wasn't it? I wonder if you wanted to sort of talk to that a little bit.
Yeah, I don't know whether it was seeing an opportunity. I joined the Foster Family Company in 1952, I think it was, and I only had 12 months there. I'd been to college. I joined them, but you know, at 17, you're still sort of enjoying life, as you were going up doing things. Not you didn't think anything about it, but as soon as I was 18, I had to go into the forces. We did national service, and both Jeff and myself, we had to go 2 years to do national service, and by coincidence, we went at the same time. And that sort of gives you a little bit of independence. You're away. Mother's not doing the washing, not doing the cooking. And we came back after 2 years, and we're looking at the company, and the company is failing. My father and uncle, they were feuding, a bit like Andy Dassler and Rudy Dassler. Rudy Dassler, though, got out of the company, and he set up Puma. That didn't happen at Foster's. They just kept feuding, never talking with each other. And there were even times when Jeff and myself had to pull them apart. So when we say seeing an opportunity, it was more or less, this company's dying. We've got to do something. And so we did. We, in 1958, we tried to get my uncle and father to change. We tried to get my father even to set up a company with us. But no, he wouldn't. So he was a bit disappointed, to say the least, when when I told him that we were leaving on that Friday evening. And by that time, we'd set up a small workshop. I say a small workshop. It was in a very large brewery. Berry Brewing Company had vacated the building many years before, but we went in and it was a bit of a shambles. But yes, that was the beginning. We started, and we started our company as Mercury Sports Footwear.
Yeah, and I think what I saw in that, though, was that, you know, there you are as a young entrepreneur with your brother thinking, look, we've got to do something. We can either bang our heads together like our uncle and our father is, or we've just got to take the big step, and a step that obviously caused problems within the family, to strike out on your own. And actually, one of the things that I know many people on the stage here today, and they are extraordinary entrepreneurs in their own right across a lot of many fields. And when they're often on stage being asked questions by the audience, you know, it comes down to things like where somebody's trying to do something that their family doesn't really want them to do, or take those risks, or develop a new business idea in a way that perhaps other people think is rash, et cetera, et cetera. So I think there'll be a lot of questions, I'm sure, that come to you when we get to that phase. I personally, and I know you and I, we communicated about this before, it actually absolutely resonated me, because I grew up in the 60s around light engineering works that my family owned, and bike building family going back to the 1900s. And your time as a traveler, as we called them, going around the country selling, you know, was it dart flights and tennis kits and things like this? This was about necessity. And probably half the audience haven't got a clue what I'm talking about, but I'm sure they'll get on to the questions. But you touched there the fact that actually you started business as Mercury. What was interesting there, of course, was that you then found, sort of after the event, that Mercury was owned by another shoe company. So you had to come up with your own brand. I think people would be fascinated just to hear how you came up with Reebok, actually, as the name and the spelling aspects to that, etc.
Yes, it's. I mean, after being in business, we're only 18 months into our small business when our accountants, he thought we were doing quite nicely, and he said, look, you've got to register your name. We hadn't even thought of that. You know, I'm 23, Jeff is 25. What do you mean, register the name? And, he said, if somebody else decides that they think that your shoes are pretty good and start making shoes with the name Mercury on it, you're going to have some problems. You're going to have to prove that it's your brand, etc. But if you register it, that's it. Okay, so we did go to a patent agent, and he checked the name, found it was Lotus and Delta, which was part of British Shoe Corporation. And he got to the point where, yes, they weren't using it, which, you know, we felt a bit miffed that they weren't using it and still had it registered. They offered us the name for £1,000. Well, I think for £250 to £400, Jeff and I had set up the whole factory. We didn't have £1,000, nowhere near. So The paint agent, he was in Manchester, he pointed through a window. It was a very nice day, in May. Pointed through a window to Kodak. And I said, well, what's with Kodak? He said, well, that's a made-up name. They made it up. They own it. They registered it. It's theirs. Nobody else can have it. And so that's easy. He said, but look, if you're going to change your name because you can't buy Mercury, bring me a 10, at least 10 names, because we need to check them through the register to see if they're available. Oh, well, the thought that you put a company there and somebody had 10 names, and it was a bit disastrous when we were thinking about it. But we came up with names like Cougar, Falcon, you know, something that was a bit aggressive. But let me take you back to 1943. I am 8 years old. And in those days during the war, again, a bit like with COVID, not much travelling going on, but we did have a local events. and I won an athletic event. I won a 60-yard race. And I went up to the, collect my prize. Oh, yes, collect my prize. What did I get? I got a dictionary. And, you know, I'm saying, come on, guys, where's the football? You know, is that something we can play with? I'm 8 years old, a dictionary. I was a bit disgusted. And I found out it was an American dictionary, where the spellings are something a little different. So we fast forward now to 1960. We're sitting down thinking about names. I pick up my dictionary, and I did like the letter R. I thought, yeah, R was it's a letter I think is strong. So I open my dictionary, my Webster's, at the letter R, and start thumbing through from there to see if I can get some inspiration. And very shortly came across R, double E, B, O, K, Reebok. I thought, what's that? And reading it, it's a small South African gazelle. Gazelle! Wow. That was it. Put that at the top of the list. This is it. It's we can be in love with that. And I took it to the patent agent, and he checked everything out, and the only thing he came up with was Reebok. That was the one. So, in a way, luck has it that way that I thought it was a better name than Mercury. It was easier to just shout Reebok. Brilliant. But, you know, had I been looking through an Oxford English dictionary, I would have found R-H-E-B-O-K and sometimes B-O-C-K, and I don't think that would have been as attractive. So,
Well, exactly. You are lucky, Joe. But, you know, that's a fantastic story, because actually, I'm not sure any child, even back then, would have thought, oh, great, a dictionary. They would have wanted a football to kick around or something of that kind. Nowadays, kids probably wouldn't know what a dictionary is. But actually, knowing the root of words and things of that kind, I still think is very important, particularly in naming and creating brands. But the fact that actually you ended up by accident getting a name that was an American spelling and has been turned into a global brand in that way, I think is fantastic fortune. So you've got a name, you've got it legally protected. People will probably roll their eyes when you say it was going to cost £1,000 and that was a lot of money, but we're talking 5 decades ago or 6 decades ago, so people have to bear that in mind. And you've got this basically light engineering type sort of business, and you decide, yeah, great, we're going to sell shoes into Britain. But you at that time had global aspirations, didn't you? And I'm just intrigued as to, you know, what do you think made you think global from almost day one, frankly? Because throughout the book, you know, this wasn't, how shall I put it? This is not a business that you led by accident into becoming a global brand. You know, right from the start, you had that ambition. And I just wonder if you've got any sense of where that came from.
Well, even at J.W. Foster's, they were selling shoes to America. They were selling shoes to Yale University. Frank Ryan and Bob Gianjack, they were head coaches there. But those were the hands-on shoes, so the volumes would not be big. But I did know that America, you know, you could go to college on a sports scholarship. So coach was God in America and at the universities and colleges. And we were in running. You know, we looked at, well, what can we do? Can we do football? I mean, the fact that my grandfather has supplied all those teams, and yet his sons or whatever happened, they never really picked up on that. But by the time Jeff and I got there, football, that was Adidas. Unfortunately, it would have cost us so much money to try and get into the football area, and we couldn't. So we stay with running and athletics. And so I knew that if we wanted a bigger company, we needed to get into a bigger market. Athletics in the UK, nice, but in America, that where it would be really big. So I learned an awful lot on selling in the UK and how to get our product onto the market. But going to the USA, the first time I went was 1968, and that's because the government. Fortunately, the government decided they wanted the sports business, or to help the sports business, export. And so they were willing to pay for a stand at the NSJ show, which is the National Sporting Goods of America show, in Chicago. They would pay for the stand. They would pay our airfare, our return airfare, and 50% of our costs was with our hotel, food, whatever. So it was almost cheaper than staying at home. That, you know, can't miss this opportunity. So with a good friend of mine, Bob Brigham, he had outdoor shops. Well, they still do. Alice Brigham was still there. And he came with me. So we turn up in Chicago, and we shoes, nice stand. And we're actually making some boots, some lightweight boots for Bob Brigham. So that's why he came along. I didn't sell any shoes. We actually sold some boots, which was good, because that meant that we'd picked up some business anyway. But the, we'll say the sports retailers who came to the stand, they liked the product and sort of said, well, you know, where do we get your product from? And I'm handing out my card, England. And they're sort of saying, is that New England? No, England across the water. Yeah. That put them off. I got nowhere with that. Absolutely nowhere. And we're talking 1968, and I actually got my distributor in 1979. And there is a story to that, and I learned an awful lot. I had six attempts, all failures, and but we kept going.
Well, I have to say, Joe, without wishing to cut you off there, I mean, this was one of the things that I drew out of this, was that actually this was no easy entry into the US market. I mean, throughout that period of time, I didn't count how many times it was, but talk about try and get knocked back and try again and get knocked back again and persist with different people. And then you make an inch and then you get knocked back too. I mean, it was quite an extraordinary sense of, you know, having to be resilient and having to have that belief that this was something you could crack. I mean, I also love the fact, I have to say, that Bob Brigham came up in this, because there was all these surprising connections and names, which I would absolutely advocate to anybody in this book. I'm not saying that you have to be of a certain age to know some of these brands and the people there, but I do think there are so many lessons in terms of resilience, persistence, the ability to build a brand from nowhere. And people was a key part of that. I mean, drawing from that sense of continually trying but getting knocked back, I mean, what advice would you have for people that find themselves in a similar situation?
Well, I think really the first thing you need is belief. If you believe in your product, if you believe that you can do it, and you've just got to keep believing. And it wasn't that the people in America didn't like our product. It was just a matter of how do you get into a market when you're trying to push your product, instead of having the opportunity where you can get the hook, as the Americans call it. And we needed the hook. That is something where the market wanted the product instead of us wanting the market. And that did come about. It came about, again, we talked about luck. We were there at the time when running came from absolutely nothing to become probably the biggest category in sport in America. It grew tremendously. Everybody's heard of Nike. Nike grew on the back of that tremendous growth of running. And that came about with a magazine, because a magazine called Runner's World, and the publisher was Bob Anderson, and he started with just an A4 sheet of paper, ended up with a full-color glossy magazine, and with the arrogance to tell everybody what shoes they should wear. This was the number one shoe. And he came up with it. For 2 years, he put the number one shoe as, I think the first one was at least Nike. Maybe the second was Nike. But Nike were importing. Phil Knight was importing from Japan. And the demand, there were probably maybe 30 or 40 million runners now starting to want shoes. And to get anything like 3 or 4 million pairs of shoes into onto the market within 12 months, virtually impossible. So the retail trade were absolutely, well, they were in shock. And so he changed it. Bob Anderson changed that from putting a number one shoe out there to star ratings. And of course, if you got a 5-star shoe, you were in. And there could be 3 or 4-star shoes. And I knew we could get a 5-star shoe. I knew. We knew the business. We knew how to make a 5-star shoe. And we did get a 5-star shoe. And in fact, we got 3 5-star shoes, as it happened in that first time they did the star rating. And that's how we got into the market.
Joe, I mean, actually, I think what's interesting to me about all of this is that you talk about luck, and we all know as entrepreneurs and as business people, you do need a bit of luck, but you make your own luck, of course. And actually, the one thing about the belief word that you know is that you know and you knew that you had a quality product. So that was the critical thing. And getting that quality product to the people that wanted such quality was simply finding the right channel. And the shift in that running magazine was that good fortune that you'd already got that relationship there and you were ready in position to take advantage of that once it happened. It's a fascinating story in the book. I do want to tell people, I mean, Joe, where can they find the book? Obviously, it's available digital, but do you just want to share exactly where you prefer people to go and get it?
Well, they can get it at leading bookstores and Amazon. It's on Amazon. In fact, it's only 1 month now since the paperback was released. So now you can get the paperback. I think the hardback's still available, but the paperback is now available.
Great.
Yes.
And audio.
And Julie Fing.
The audio, yes.
Yeah. Of course, the audio as well, which would be well worth listening to as well. So it's out there. It is not surprisingly called Shoemaker, and it's by Joe. And please do follow Joe. If you're not doing it already, because actually Joe does go into other rooms. I have, this is how we've met. We've obviously communicated since, but we've met. And, you know, actually, it is a fascinating story, as I say, about a whole load of different contexts of building the business, but also the building of brand, breaking into new markets. Now, before we just progress, I'm just going to say, remind people that we have the Winners Club, which is the little green house above Joe's head. So please tap on that if you're not following it already, because this is where you'll get quality conversations. Please let's all just refresh our screens and pull on down. We've got some great friends that I'm going to come on to on the stage that will have, I know, fascinating questions, but I'm just going to sort of carry on slightly through the story so people get more of a context, etc. I was struck, actually, you talked there about the running, but the other thing that really surprised me was the arrival of aerobics, which also was a huge thing for you. It sounds very similar, but then you get people popping up in your book like Jane Fonda and things like this, which is quite extraordinary. I mean, aerobics, before it was a thing, suddenly became a thing, and you grabbed that like no other company, didn't you?
Well, we were very young on that, on the American market, and we were doing very nicely at running. We were a small running company, great, but we had a tech rep. Her tech rep goes round to the stores. He doesn't sell the product. He goes in and he talks to the salesman and he shows them exactly what the good points of the shoe that they should be telling to prospective buyers. So he's in Los Angeles, and his wife Frankie is coming home from these aerobic classes, and with her friends, they're absolutely full of it. Fantastic. I mean, Arnold says, Frankie, what's this about? And aerobics, well, what is that? And she said, well, it's exercising to music. But really, you know, today's music, fantastic, we love it. So Arnold decided he'd go down to the next one of these and have a look. He did. And he saw the instructor there in trainers, half the class in trainers, the other half, no shoes at all. Obviously, this was a light bulb moment for Arnold. And he thought, why don't we make a shoe specifically for women and specifically for aerobics? Well, he went up to Boston to see Paul Fireman, who was running the operation with running, and said, Paul, look, this is going on in L.A. Fantastic. I think it's going to be big. And Paul was sort of a bit, come on, you know, we're a running company and we're doing very nicely. What on earth do we want to sort of start making a few shoes for some girls dancing around? Barney wasn't put off. He went round to the back to see Steve Liggett. Steve Liggett was in charge of production, and he was very persuasive and said, look, just make me 200 pairs. He got his 200 pairs. He took them down to Los Angeles and he gave them to the instructors. And as John was saying, also, we had Jane Fonda, who actually bought a pair of shoes, but the girls loved them. They absolutely loved them. And to the point where instead of just taking them for the aerobics class, they started wearing them on the street, going to work, going out, and that was it. Reebok suddenly became a woman's company. Not many people knew us outside the running fraternity, and Nike, Adidas, they were really male, sweaty. So this was just something the women could own. And all of us, that just exploded incredibly. And it became part of Hollywood. You know, the company grew from a $9 million company to $30 million, to $90 million, to $300 million, then $900 million in successive years. And the big problem was not how do we create sales, it's how do we get the product.
Sorry, Jake, carry on.
From 300 million revenue to 900 million revenue takes an awful lot of product. Unfortunately for us, Nike had just run into bad times and had to come out of some of the factories. So Reebok were able to go into those factories, and we still had a problem satisfying demand. And I know I used to sit down with Paul, and Paul would say, look, Joe, I know how to stop this, but if I do, I don't know how to start it again. So we just had to keep running, just keep running and keep making. But, you know, it did create a very nice winning culture, a fantastic winning culture. And people were just willing to work hard and keep the pressure on. And it built to a $4 billion company, or just short of $4 billion, when I decided time for me to retire.
Well, you know, there's a lot of billionaires on this platform, of course. I'd say that tongue-in-cheek, but, you know, verifiable billion businesses are few and far between. And, Joe, I think there's a couple of things there that come out of that and came out of the book with me. I mean, the first thing was that you saw this transition from your footwear being purely for a track or for an activity in that way to your footwear being something that was worn fashionably in other contexts. Now, that must have been quite an interesting change. And then I will come on after I get your reflection on that, come on to this thing about feeding the beast, because throughout the book, you know, you do talk about the production problems. So, you know, in the old days where you had your factory sitting in the northwest of England, churning out a set amount and posting them off, etc., in a very simplified way, that's one thing, but entirely unsustainable and requiring, obviously, your outsourcing to the east and the global supply chains, which takes it into an entirely different management situation. But, you know, just before we talk a little bit about that, this transition from sportswear to leisurewear and fashionwear, I mean, thoughts on this? Because, of course, frankly, you know, when you were growing up, people had different sorts of clothes for different sorts of things, and it's all changed a bit now, hasn't it?
Well, yes. I mean, we can go back to grandfather. The fact that he had gold medals and world records was the fact that he knew how to promote his product. He knew how to influence. But in those days, you were influencing other performers. And so that's fine. Created your business, built your business, a performance business. When we came to running and then aerobics, what had changed is that the street was being influenced. Even Adidas were influencing the street back down in the 60s, because the kids wore these the replica outfits for football clubs. The you know, they would do that and trainers, so they became street. But once we were doing with aerobics, and the women just owned that, and it expanded, really has expanded onto the street, and the influence. We then became a fashion company. And if you really ask anybody in Nike or Adidas or Reebok today, yes, they're all fashion companies. And it's to do with influencers. And so the influence now, it's good to influence with performance. And a lot of the football clubs, as you know, they're all sponsored by either Nike, Adidas, some Reebok or whatever. That's fine. But the volume is street. And yeah, you know, so now to influence people, you need to be looking at, well, what is influencing today? And it's the young people. And, you know, people ask me, well, you know, what do you think is influencing the street? And I usually ask how old they are. And they come, oh, I'm 24, 25. Well, I said, you tell me what's influencing. Because if I was still running the company, I would be asking you.
Yeah.
That's where the market is.
Well, that's great, Joe. And I know, I mean, a lot of people actually have big influence on this platform in different ways. And I'm sure that will feature in the question. Just to remind everybody in the audience, I tend to have these conversations and open it up for questions from our friends on the stage and elsewhere. I've got just a couple of reflections, and then we'll open up popcorn style about people who might like to ask Joe a question and get into the discussion. But Joe, that switch, just to go back to feeding that beast, finding the production, the challenges around quality, because you had a couple of situations where quality sort of let you down, although it sort of was able to be turned around. So I have a question really about, you know, how you overcome some of those challenges. And then the final thing that I'd like to talk about before we open it up is really just the sense of people, because what struck me about your book, which is highly unusual, is that as you get to the end of the book, you have a whole section upon the people that you thank, the people that you give credit to, the people that helped build the business with you over many, many years. And I think that's a really touching, insightful aspect to obviously how you led that business. But we'll come on to that in a moment. But just any thoughts on the global supply situation and quality controls and things like that? That may spark thoughts for people to ask you questions later.
Well, when I was at the 1979 NSGA show, and we were just going for a five-star shoe. I knew that if we were to succeed, we would need more production. Our factory couldn't cope with the production that I knew would come out of this. So I had already talked to Bata, and I had a friend there who just set up the sports division of Bata. And yes, Bata will make shoes if you're looking for volume. I'd also had contact with people in South Korea who had a London office. So we were preparing for more volume, and because I had a visit from Kmart. Kmart, a massive retailer in America, and they wanted 25,000 pairs, but they wanted them at a better price. And so it was a good job. I knew that this would come up because production of sports footwear, well, production of a lot of things, it was moving to the Far East. And in that time, it was South Korea. So we had to be prepared for that. But as your company grows, you need a lot of people. And you also need to short circuit how the demand is sort of covered. And so we, with the American market being the one that we wanted to grow, I sent my team of designers and experts over to America. We put the whole thing in America so that America would be able to get direct from Korea and satisfy the market. I didn't want to be, I don't think the American market would have wanted a guy from the north of England to try and tell them what the market is. No, we had an American, we had Paul Fireman, and I just made sure that he had all the tools that we had, the designs, the ideas, everything. We made sure he had it, and he had a good team there that could then grow. And it needed to grow. And as I said, I retired when we were out for $4 billion. And, you know, you've got a whole bunch of lawyers in the company, a whole bunch of accountants, and a lot of people in between who were making the product, supplying the product, and working hard. And, you know, because we were doing so well, we had grown a tremendous winning culture. So everybody was willing to get in there. So, you know, whilst I've got people in the book, most of those people helped me when we were very small. People like John Willie Johnson, who just let me have just machinery. He gave me machinery that I couldn't afford. And yeah, other people, just like that. And, you know, it's something that really I put down to the fact that Reebok was successful because we took people in, we talked to people, and people were so willing to help in those very early days. And and that was part of our growth. The most important part of our growth was having the right people.
Well, Joe, that is a tremendous sort of statement to start to open the room up on. I mean, I think that, again, throughout the book, as you explain there with different people like Paul Fireman and others, there was an enormous belief, I think, in you and your products, but there was also a great amount of goodwill in certain circumstances, as you've just alluded to, for example, in the donation of equipment, you know, the things of that kind. And we actually have on this stage at the moment people from both the UK, the US, and maybe even people elsewhere. So it'll be interesting to get even an international perspective on some of the questions that come through. I mean, I see people here that I know. So I want to now open up the room for questions, really. And I'm going to come to... Sorry, who is that, I wonder? Could you just wait for a moment? Sorry, whoever
sure,
that is.
Sure, yeah. Yes.
Yeah, sorry, Garrett, if you could just wait for a moment, please. So I'm being terribly British about that. I hope you won't mind. But if people would like to just indicate by flashing their mics, then I can move on down. So we've got James, and we've got Lucienne, we've got Julie, my good friend Julie, we've got Mary, and obviously, there's quite a few. So Garrett, if you don't mind, if you can just hold on a couple of minutes, I'm going to go to one of the founders of the Clubhouse, of course, who's already suggested that he's in a fan moment sitting next to Josie. So, Lucienne. Okay, Lucienne, what would you like to say? Oh, my goodness. Is anybody hearing me? Is it just Lucienne lost?
We're hearing
Julie.
You.
Okay. Well, Julie. People are unmiking, interestingly, and not being heard, or certainly not by me. We'll come back to that. Julie Lyle, great friend of mine, one of the global CMOs of great renown. Over to you, Julie.
Thank you, John. I'm sure that James and Lucienne are having some glitches, but Joe, just lovely to listen to you. And I have not read the book, but am eager to do so. Unfortunately, Audible version is not available in the U.S., but I have the print version on the way. My question to you is the family values, typically in family, multi-generational family businesses, the family values that Reebok espoused and demonstrated in the market in being innovative and in being really spotting trends, in riding the running and aerobic wave, in understanding barefoot runners and the opportunity there, the performance wear to streetwear movements, private label, global manufacturing. Those are not spotting those trends versus being drugged by them, if not chasing them, is typical in multi-generational families. What was it about your family core values that had you and Reebok embrace these changes and stay ahead of them, if not on top of them?
Well, it's rather funny because as I was speaking and I said that it took us some time before we really knew grandfather's story. But grandfather's story, we were already, Jeff and I were already Reebok and doing very nicely when we sort of looked at our backstory and found so much about grandfather. And so there must have been some DNA there that said, you know, opportunities are out there. You've got to look at them and try them. So the family was good. But his sons, there were my father and uncle, there was 6 years difference between them. I don't know even to today, I can't even recall what's made them feud. What did that? And when my grandfather died in 1933, I was born in 1935. Incidentally, I was born on his birthday. That's why they call me Joe. I came up with the name. And so I don't know why father and uncle, but they didn't continue that enthusiasm. Grandfather had built such a good business that my father and uncle, they just lived really on the strength of the business. A lot of it was international. So, but they didn't see that they needed to change. I don't know whether it was two world wars that sort of made them think differently, or they were just happy that the wars were over and, you know, they were not then thinking about the business. But surprisingly enough, Jeff and myself, we looked at this business and we did have the opportunity eventually to look back at grandfather. And this is why he's such an important part of my book, because I do believe that we had picked up something that maybe in the genes, maybe we didn't recognize the fact that we were in the athletics business. It was something that maybe was there, but unthinkingly, you know, we knew we had to carry on with the family heritage, which is now over 125 years old, and that's incredible. So, yeah, we valued that, and we did value that, and we were able to pick up on whatever the changes were. And, I mean, unfortunately, my brother didn't live beyond just when we arrived into the American market. He got cancer of the stomach, and he died, which was terrible for me. And he would have loved to see where we went with Reebok. But I think that, you know, these things have they're double-edged swords in a way. Jeff died, but I was able to make decisions without even talking to anybody. I could do it then. And that was probably fortunate in many ways, because I could make those decisions. And if they were wrong, I could change them. But, you know, it was a big problem for me at the time. Because Jeff loved the factory, and that's we had an arrangement where Jeff would make the product, he'd work the factory, that's all he wanted, and he said, Joe, you do the rest. So that's why I was the traveller, I was the one pushing all the time. And you talk about family, beyond the sort of family tradition, you have your own family. And I know it was difficult for my family, because I was always away on my son's birthday. I was in February in Chicago. And as an American, you'll know Chicago is very cold in February. but I was always there, and that was my son's birthday. So in when we talk family, we talk many different aspects of it. And today, Adidas, who own the shares, are selling them. And I'm just so excited that we can rebuild a lot of the family, the Reebok following, because we did have a lot of fun. It was tremendous in America. I think 60% of the USA citizens actually bought a pair of Reeboks when that would be during the 80s and 90s.
I mean, that was a great question, Julie. Thank you, Joe. Great response. And actually, I would say that in the book, family features very heavily in a whole different sort of set of ways, particularly also your own family and living above the factory and things of this kind. Let's stick with America. Let's go to Garrett, who was bound with enthusiasm, wanted to jump in. Garrett, have you got your question, your comment there? And then I'll come back and see if James and Lucienne are ready for that.
I sure do. And thank you so much, Sean. And you're not too British for me, so everything's fine.
Okay, thank you.
No, I have a really personal story, Joe, and I'm so grateful I can share it. So I want to thank you and thank Reebok. I actually was born and grew up in Canton, Massachusetts.
Oh, right. And
that's where Reebok's headquarters were.
Yes,
and
indeed.
And when I came out of engineering school at EE, I founded and started, and I was the owner of a company called OmniFlex, and we had our facilities in Canton, Massachusetts, on Route 138, not far from Reebok. And you guys inspired us in a lot of ways. You know, we were a physical workout equipment company. I just texted you, by the way, in your Instagram account, the brochures from 1980.
Good.
It's really the NSGA show, the National Sporting Association show, McCormick Place, Chicago. Right. And we were always, I always made sure we were across from you. And our models would go, and if you had extra inventory, we'd convince your reps to let our models wear the latest Reebok, which wasn't really out yet. And sometimes they convinced them, and sometimes they didn't. But what we did was, my company, we saw the aerobic trend, and we leveraged personal trainers, because a lot of times people couldn't afford, this is back in the 80s, they couldn't afford to go to gyms, or they didn't have the time. And then there was a secondary market that people hired in-house trainers. So we actually had aerobic trainers wearing Reeboks, selling our equipment to their clients. That was about a $6,000 sale. So it was kind of like a Peloton play before the internet, you know? Right. So the equipment, they all wore Reebok stuff. We had a store attached to our manufacturing plant called Fitstop. We had Reebok shoes. We had some, you know, tops and bottoms, and the trainers would hang out. And so anyway, I'm just a huge fan of Reebok, always have been. And my question, we often regret what we didn't do, right? And I was curious if you have any regrets about things you didn't do while you were with Reebok.
Well, interestingly, no. It's one of the questions that I get asked, have you any regrets? And, my journey was fantastic. I loved it. Yeah, I went around the world 3 times a year. I met a lot of people. We had all the Hollywood stars come to Monte Carlo when we were doing the Princess Grace tennis tournaments. And, those people were so great. You know, and Reebok, okay, we had some tough times, but we became number one. We overtook Adidas. We overtook Nike. And we were numero uno in the trade. And when you think about it, what more do you want? How can you regret that? No matter which way, how it gets, the only thing that is so saddening is that, you lose people. Jeff lost a son. I lost a daughter. Then I lost Jeff. And, those are the things that you wish you could change. But, no, we can't change those. And for regrets, no, I don't have any regrets. It was a magnificent journey, and I'm still taking it. Amazingly enough, I'm still here, and I don't know. Either I can't get away from Reebok, or they can't get away from me.
Well, Sorry, Jay, go on. I'm sort of laughing because what a great thing.
And go on, sorry. I often liken it to the Eagles who have Hotel California. You can check out, but you can never leave.
That's a great thing. That's a great thing to answer that. And Garrett, great insight there to your early connections with Reebok as well. Thank you for that. Yeah. And I would say that in the book, there is a heck of a lot of glamorous individuals' names pops up. You know, and you talked about the Princess Grace tennis tournament there, and the touching element that Prince Rania did at that time, things of that kind. I mean, I think, you know, there's a lot of richness in this book, which I'm sure a lot of people will be very interested in. And it is, of course, available. And as I say again, please follow Joe so that you know when he pops up again. Please follow the Winners Club, which is above, and follow the founders of that, Paul, Ashley, James, and the people that regularly host, like Lucienne and others, all on this stage. So if you want to be a part of these conversations, please do become part of that community. So Gareth, thank you for that. Did you want to add anything before I move on? Are you okay?
No, I'm good. I'm just thankful to be listening, and sorry I came in later. I would, you know, just great. Thanks for having us.
No, that's grand. Can you just check your mics? Right, I'm going to move down the stage. James, I've had a message from. He can't. He's just listening. He's just sort of going to listen in the background. There is somebody, I don't know, with a live mic. I think it's Kante. I'm going to mute you if you don't mind. Thank you. Lucienne, there you are.
Hello.
Very patient. Can we hear
can you
this
hear
time?
Me?
Yes,
can you hear
yes,
me?
We can. We can. Over to you.
God for that. Oh, dearie me, what a disaster. Thank you so much, John and Joe, for creating this conversation. Amazing. I was a massive sports fan as a young person, involved in a lot of county sports. And unfortunately, my mum was really poor and could never afford anything brand. So I was always really ashamed when I went out onto the pitch, and it was a sad time. But the first time I received anything branded, it was a pair of high top Reeboks that were black, and they were so incredible, and they got stolen a week later, and it was tragic. It was so sad. So yes, always been a very, very big fan, and thank you so much for all that you do. My question is, there's lots of layers around competition. There's obviously the family feud, there's competition within the sporting world, and there's also the giants that you're competing against, like Nike and Adidas. How important is it to have that level of competition when you're running a business? Does it help you grow your success, or is it something that hinders you, do you think, Joe?
Well, you can't avoid competition. That's particularly in the sporting categories. I didn't really worry too much about Nike or Adidas. I think that we made our own path, and it was great to do that, because both Nike and Adidas were massive compared to Reebok for quite a long time, and so it was a wonderful thing to become number one. You know, but it wasn't something that we were striving for. We actually became number one company because, well, in fact, we couldn't help but we had to keep up with the demand, and that's what drove us to number one. But I think what is useful about the competition is you see that they have to pick up on or follow your trends, or you have to follow their trends. You know, if it's winning, if something is winning. Where with Reebok, the good thing was that, as I said before, Nike and Adidas, they were both male and sweaty, whereas Reebok were not known like that. So we became this very nice woman's company, and they stood back and thought, no, aerobics isn't, you know, that's going to be a fad, it's going to be over within 12 months, nothing. And of course it took us to number one. So were they really looking at us or not? I think they were, but I think they missed an opportunity to get into a sport. But then again, you know, we became a woman's company, and I think it was difficult for them to try to follow us because of what they were already known for. So opposition, you do know your opposition. And if you read my book, you'll find that we used to sneak on the Adidas stand. Never sneaked on the Nike stand. I think we're a bit too big to get away with that one. But we used to sneak on the stand and have a look at what they were doing, what the latest products were. But I do think, you know, you need the right people, the right influences, and they're the things you've got to be different with. You've got to be able to do something different. You know, Reebok brought in that lovely soft leather. Previous to that, most sports shoes were fairly hard leather. Running shoes were soft, but Reebok really brought that in. Brought it in with the aerobic shoe, and then with the classics. So that was a change which really has changed sports footwear. Everybody wears sports footwear now because they're more comfortable. It's, you know, instead of wearing sort of street shoes now, and this is what we are. We're fashion, as I think Adidas and Nike and more or less all our competitors are fashion now.
Thanks, Joe. Great answer. And thank you, Lucien, for that wonderful question as well. So, and also that tragic story of the theft of your trainers at that time. I hope they've been replaced by now. Right, I'm moving down the line from Susan to Dale. Anybody wants to give me a flash of mic in that space, we'll move down. So the one person, Joyal, hi, how are you? And do you have a question for Joe?
I do. Joe, fantastic story. Great listening to your story. And I think a bit like Lucine, we'll all have attachments to when we first had our Reebok gear. And I think mine was the Reebok DMX running shoes. Thank you for those. Those are the first decent pair of training running shoes I had. My question is, in terms of endorsements, what single person probably, in terms of endorsements, helped your company grow?
Well, that's a tough one because... I mean, really, as we'll say that Kanye West helped Adidas, and we're looking at Johnson did for Nike. Maybe Shaquille O'Neal was probably one of the most influential. But I think a product like the Pump, I think that really sort of boosted the brand. Plus the fact that we were being worn by so many. I think we probably took it away from performance and a lot of the stars in the film stars, people like that, they started wearing our shoes, and that's where a lot of the influence came from for Reebok. So when it comes to athletes, I don't know. I mean, if we go back really way back, we had Ron Hill. And Ron Hill was our best marathon runner in the UK. And so all these people, you know, they did influence the brand. And I think people like Ron Hill made us, I think we were really punching above our weight. We were recognized as really quality, the best running shoes in the UK in our time. And so this varies. As today, now most of the influencers have nothing to do with sport. But that's how the world changes, because now we're all fashion. And so it's Ariana Grande and Gal Gadot. You know, they're the people that now Reebok are using.
Great question, Joel. Thank you. And great answer, actually. And going back to the fact that, you know, many of the influencers are nothing to do with actually sport performance anymore. So flash of mics, please. We've got about half an hour. So I'm coming. I see you, Keanu. I see you, Jackie. But I'm going to come to Mary first. Mary, would you like to ask Joe your question?
Oh, hi, Joe. Thank you very much for sharing your story. It's really, really inspirational. What I would ask is, if when you look back now over the whole journey from start to finish, is there anything that you would have done differently if you were given the chance, putting yourself back in that position? And was there ever a moment where you thought, ugh, this just isn't going to work, or that you felt like you were close to giving up?
Well, probably many, many things I would have done differently. I'm sure that Jeff, who was very solid, worked in the factory, he knew what my father and uncle had been like, how they had feuded and fought. We never had a bad word. We never had a crossword. And if I did something, and I probably did a lot of stupid things, you know, you think about some of the things you've done, and would you change them? Well, I don't know, because if you change one little bit of the Reebok history, you probably then change a lot. And, you know, we became number one. It's like, well, maybe all these little problems, the failures,
taken 11 years to get into the American. Maybe that was the building block. You know, maybe understanding that we could have done some things differently. But, you know, as I say, we became number one. So it's hard to regret anything, and it's hard to think you could change anything. Yeah, as I've said, the only thing, if I could and I couldn't, that would be the fact that Jeff would still be here today and be able to join me in these conversations and enjoy what we did with Reebok. But, again, difficult to say. Which way would you go? You often come to a division in the road. Well, should I go this way? Should I have gone with Kmart and taken their order for 25,000? Or should I have done what I did and go with Paul Feynman and suffer the problem that we needed finance, we needed all sorts of things? But no. And I still think I took the right route. But I'm sure if Jeff was here today, he could probably say, well, I know what you did wrong. You did that wrong. You did that wrong. But, you know, we got through.
Well, you know, again, I do recommend the book, Joe. Keep going on about this. And you do get a sense of the absence, obviously, from the way you speak and what Jeff might have been like in going through. But I think that perspective and that reflection is something we can all take away with us. I think, Pianta, you were next. Nice to see you here. You have a...
Hey, thank you so much, John. This is an excellent room. It's always a pleasure to be in the Winners Club, and I want to apologize to everyone for the noise around me because I am in New York City. With that being said, for a long time, I traveled America promoting footwear trends, sneaker trends on the news for Foot Locker, and I had developed relationships with all of the sneaker companies, and I recognized that just things weren't just going exactly the way I wanted them to go at Foot Locker. I reached out to my friends at Reebok, and Reebok stepped up. They gave me sponsorship dollars, as well as unlimited products, and they supported me as I traveled America promoting sneakers. They put money into my pocket. I just want to salute you because you created a lot of jobs. You helped a lot of livelihoods on so many levels, from your employees to your PR agencies to everybody. So thank you so much for your support. Have a great day. This is Kayente, Captain Young Money, and I'm landing my plane.
Fabulous.
Isn't that lovely, Kayente? Thank you. I mean, that's a lovely endorsement there, Joe. It's one thing that, right, you know, people often think about making money for themselves, but also in making money and building businesses, they're putting money in the pockets of others, and they're building opportunities for others, and they're putting roofs over the families of others. I don't know what you want to say to that.
Well, all I can say is that Reebok, and we were all so fortunate. You're so fortunate if you can do that and to be in that position. And we know there are lots of people who are in that position, but it's still good fortune to be privileged enough to be able to reach that situation where you can help people. It's good.
Well, that is great, and I hope everybody's joining the Joe Foster Fan Club by following Joe and the Winners Club, of course, and those people that make this happen. Jackie, you were next, and I see Nichelle, my good friends Nichelle and Ilana, we're going to come to. Jackie, you have a question for Joe or something to say.
I do indeed, John. Good to see you again. Hey, Joe, lovely to meet you here on Clubhouse. For me, relationships and communications are very important. So what did you do within Reebok to maintain and sustain good relationships, leadership in your organization that helped to make you a success? This is Jackie in the red, and I'm complete.
I think we were fortunate. We grew a very successful company. And, you know, we've got to put this down mainly to women, mainly to aerobics. That's the one thing that really drove the company to the size that it became. And I think when it comes to people, you just it's infectious. It's something, if you have the right spirit, if you have the right attitude, and you know, you give people the authority, the ability to do something, to succeed themselves, and if you do that, this is infectious throughout the company, and everybody enjoys and loves working in a company. And if you can create that wonderful culture, then, you know, everybody gains by it. and certainly communication, as you've said. And if you read my book, you'll find that I had a lot of people that that I could mention, and you know how fantastic it was to be able to build with those sort of people.
Great answer, Joe. Thank you for that. Nichelle, nice to see you here. Over to you.
Hi, John. Thank you. Hi, Joe. I was born on my grandpa's birthday, and I wasn't. I'm from the north as well, but I wasn't called Wilf. but I was going to ask you about culture, actually. But Jackie beat me to it. But just going then back to northern roots and how much, because I'm very proud of as being a northerner, come from a northern family, and that grit and that determination and that appreciation for your roots, how much of that was embedded in your DNA whilst building your, whilst building your business and instilling that culture within Reebok?
Well, I think it has to be in you. It's like, you know, people who say my glass is half full or half empty. I think you have to be an optimistic person. You have to have imagination. And I think, I don't know whether that's part of DNA, whether it's born in you. I don't think you can. I think most of that has to be in you. And certainly northern grit, yes. It is a very important part. We were the Industrial Revolution. And I think you grow up with a lot of people who worked in the mills, you know, did the things that needed doing at that time. And I go back to thinking of the street that I lived in, which was a terrace street. Everybody knew everybody. You could leave your doors open, and everybody has got that friendship. You know, I think that is so important in saying, well, you know, how do you manage to stick with this? And yes, you know, I think that grit is there, and it's very important. But I think it's part of your character. And possibly northern grit is character making. So, you know, maybe that's it. Maybe we both have the same grit.
Well, brilliant. Thank you.
Yeah, I mean, that's great. Grit, it's fantastic, as long as you don't get it in your Reebok when you're running, because that can be a bit, a bit painful. I'm seeing any other flashings of mics. I know I'm coming to Ilana next. Hope I don't miss anybody, so pipe up if I do. Ilana, over to you.
Shall I go ahead, John?
Yes, over to you, Ilana. Thank you.
Thank you so much. Sorry, I wasn't sure if you were carrying on. Thank you, Joe. I could listen to you all day. It's so lovely listening to the story that you've been on with your organisation. And and I was going to ask you about values, but I think you just covered that really quite a lot with the previous question. So just a sort of extension on that. I deal with heritage brands, and I think when we're dealing with heritage brands, as you are, the longer the time, I think, that you've been in business, the longer your vantage point on the future of business. And I'm just curious, given where we're at the moment, I think values are a really important component of future businesses. I think a lot of decisions will be made on values. And I just wonder what your thoughts are on future business and that family type structure that you've obviously embraced within a business and the culture. And I'm just curious as to your thoughts of what will make a successful business in the landscape that we're moving into.
Changing times, aren't they? we have gone through COVID, and that has been quite disastrous for a lot of people. But, you know, it has pushed technology forward. And now I think you have to acknowledge the value that the technology is bringing, and it's changing a lot of things. We're finding that the high street now is not as appetizing as it used to be, and we're all shopping online. So things are changing, but I don't think that values change. You know, it's a question of, when you make a product and you sell your product, you have to believe in it, and you have to be willing to stand up and say, yes, I made that product. You know, so I think that the values are quite important. If you're really going to have a company that you can be proud of, I love Reebok, and I always have. And as I said, I'm even still part of Reebok now, because I think we did have values, and we had values globally. In fact, Reebok have just set up, what is this set up now?
The foundation.
Excuse me. Which was, what foundation? It's the
Humanitarian Foundation.
It's the Humanitarian Foundation. They've just relaunched it. And I think that it looks at things in the Far East. It looks at where we get our product from to make sure that we value those people. And, we give them fair money for the product. So values, I think if you don't have values, I think your business is going to be short-lived. I really do. But, that's my take on it.
Great. Well, great message, Joe. And I know Ilana actually does a huge amount of work in that, because I know Ilana in the real world as well. So thank you. I'm just conscious that we've got probably about 15 minutes before we wrap up the room. We've had a heck of a lot of Joe's time, which is fantastic and great insight. So flashing mics. I see Heather, you're flashing. Of course, it could be applauded. I see Marilyn flashing. But Heather caught my eye first. I'll come to you, Marilyn, afterwards. Good, quick questions, and we'll get through as many as we can before we close the room. Over to you, Heather.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much. And first off, congratulations on all of the winning, Joe. I mean, obviously, you have built a tremendous organization, and there's so much to be said for that. I love the comment earlier just about all of the jobs and everything that you've created. And, you know, there's a lot of things that have changed, you know, since you started this organization, and especially, you know, circling around the climate, you know, and because the climate conversation is such a huge topic and an immediate issue, right? I mean, quite frankly, for the survival of humanity, and you are in this very elite, you know, global community. Do you see the same urgency in your circle of friends to support like these global initiatives right now? And if so, is there an organization that stands out that you definitely do support? This is Heather Jane, and I'm done.
Well, yes, and I think that's an important part of business today. I think business today has to take climate into serious consideration. I know right now that I think it's one of the latest shoes that is made of vegetation, that Reebok are making that. And what they were saying is that when you wear out your shoes, all you need to do is to dig a hole and bury it, because it's made of vegetables, and it's just going back to where it came from.
That would be fantastic. Great question, Heather. Great response. The way you said that, though, Joe, I just sort of, instead of burying it, why don't you eat it? You know, I mean, I have to say, I'm not making light of this, because I'm in this world as well. But actually, it does give great thinking, actually.
Well, maybe it will grow something you can eat.
Well, there you go.
And I've seen that. And John, if I could just say one thing really quick. Like, Joe, are you seeing the same urgency? I've seen Reebok's campaigns. I know 2030, they've got recycled shoes and plant-based shoes. I love it. You know, I think it's fantastic. And that's a huge move in the right direction just for shoe companies as a whole. But like in your group of friends, are you seeing those same conversations of urgency to like support the global initiatives right now?
I think a lot of people are very interested in that. But I think COVID itself has more or less taken conversation away. We don't meet many people, or we haven't been meeting many people. We've all been in lockdown, and I have been in serious lockdown. I'm 86 now, so they consider me a very serious person to keep locked down. I'm hopeful within probably the next 3 or 4 months, we're going to be back meeting people again and discussing the importance of the global economy, of really preserving the planet. And I do know that Reebok are working in that direction. And anybody who is seriously in business has to make that consideration. You know, it's the same with cars these days. Everything is going towards electric, and they're going as fast as they can. So it is important. And yes. You know,
great question. Thanks, Joe.
Thank you, Joe. Yeah.
Right.
Okay. Thanks, Heather. Marilyn, and then we'll keep moving through as quickly as I can. Marilyn, over to you.
Wonderful. Thank you so much, John. And thank you, Joe. And I have to say, I was a Reebok Step girl, and I really regret giving it away when I moved house, because it was such good quality. Haven't found anything that comes close. So Thanks for that. Now, you've said that you're still involved with Reebok. You've mentioned the foundation. So is that it for you for the time being in terms of business? Or do you have aspirations and plans to launch another business? And if so, what might that be?
Look, I'm seriously busy. I'm seriously busy selling a book. I have so many conversations, and I'm on Zoom every other day. Yeah, so my business right now is making Shoemaker a number one bestseller.
Great answer. I'm going to move swiftly on. So thank you, Marilyn, for that question. I can see Laura, you are the winner, and you are looking very sporty. So Laura, ask your question. Fire away.
Yes. Hi, Joe. It's an honor to meet you. I've been running my whole life. I was, I'm an ultra runner, and did own many pairs of Reeboks and aerobics during college. And a pair of Reeboks is still in my one and only golf, corporate golf, golf club bag. So thank you. And what I admire about you is how humble you are. You know, the Nike and Reebok story and the competition, that the fierce competition that happened to Nike during, you know, you mentioned when you were talking about how Nike was going through challenges, you know, you and your team and your entire company, I mean, it was like the Coke Pepsi challenges. So just amazing story, amazing, humble, amazing, amazing story. So thank you so much for sharing that. And I don't really have a question. I just wanted to thank you so much.
Well, that's been a pleasure. It really has. my journey with Reebok has been a pleasure. And it's people like yourself that we hope have enjoyed taking the journey with us.
That's a great way to end, Joe. Joe, thank you so much for your time. I've just been reflecting, really, on the great conversation that we've had. I'm so pleased that you've enjoyed it as well, as so many people have been in the room. If I think back, I think of... There's a number of points that come back to me. The first was that right at the start of your story, actually a lesson for all entrepreneurs, is that you recognize that there were circumstances that were beyond your control and that you couldn't change, namely the family disruption between and the feud between your father and your uncle, which meant that you and your brother had to actually step out and take your own path. And sometimes, of course, you know, there are lots of factors which distract people to stay in situations which they can't control because they want and feel that they need to try and control those. So that was a big learning there for me from the book and from the conversation. I think belief in yourself, but also most importantly, belief in your product undoubtedly came through and became the basis of your success. You talked about luck in terms of the running and getting the 5-star product and then the emergence of aerobics. But frankly, as we all know, you make your own luck by knowing the right people, being in the right place, and of course, having the quality that people want. I like the fact you said, don't worry about the competition, be aware of the competition, but make your own path. People have absolutely been throughout this conversation, recruiting people better than you, but making them feel part of a family so that you all collectively can go that further. And I think the one reflection before I hand over to Paul as one of the founders of the Winners Club, the one reflection I would say is that throughout this, and particularly listening from those people who have asked questions, is that actually the Reebok brand creates and has created great warmth. And I've been trying to think why that might be. And I think it's because it touches the memories of people. It is like when Lucien had that incredibly special pair of trainers for the first time. Or where Stephen had that particular experience of being going out, acting as the rock star in that equipment. You've created memories based on success and achievement and making people feel special, going from the track to the pavement or the sidewalk. So, Joe, I think that's a tremendous reflection. I recommend your book. So please go and get Shoemaker by Joe Foster, available in all good bookshops and probably some pretty poor bookshops as well.
Thanks for listening to this episode of The Winners Club. If you have taken some practical lessons and learnings from some of the most impactful conversations on Clubhouse, then we would love your support for this show by leaving us a 5-star review wherever you download your podcasts.